Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon. We'll learn about the 10th anniversary celebration for the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. We'll hear the fifth installment of Midnight Oil about how the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline has affected our state. And we'll meet Salt Chef Nell Utipa, recently crowned King of Alaska Seafood in New Orleans. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more on a Juno Afternoon. Taking a look at the weather in a sentence: rain likely through Sunday. Highs in the mid-50s. Stay tuned for a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. A Muscogee Creek citizen and former police officer accused of murder is citing a recent jurisdiction ruling in asking an Oklahoma judge to dismiss his case. Shannon Kepler is facing his fourth trial in the 2014 shooting death of his daughter's boyfriend. The Tulsa World reports a motion filed Friday argues that Shannon Kepler is a Muscogee Creek citizen and the killing happened within tribal territory, so the state does not have the authority to prosecute him. The motion relies on a Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling last week that said Congress never formally abolished the Creek Reservation, despite breaking it up into individual allotments back in 1901. Legal experts say that appellate ruling could change how members of any tribe are prosecuted for crimes committed within the historical boundaries of the Creek Nation. According to the Tulsa World, the Oklahoma Attorney General's office is expected to appeal and ask for a stay of the Tenth Circuit ruling. Kepler's previous trials have all ended in hung juries, and the fourth is scheduled to begin in October. The Stillaguamish tribe in Washington state did not sign away its sovereign immunity in a 2005 agreement to build a retaining wall. That's according to a ruling by a federal judge last week in a suit involving the state over a deadly landslide in 2014 near Oso, Washington. U.S. District Court Judge Robert J. Bryan granted the tribe's motion for summary judgment. He says the tribe did not take any action that waives its sovereign immunity. The immunity dispute arose after victims of the landslide sued the state over decisions that led up to the disaster. The state claimed the tribe was among the parties responsible because the retaining wall increased the severity of the landslide. A lawyer for the tribes tells Law360.com that the decision is an important affirmation of tribal sovereignty. The Southern Ute Tribe has committed $1 million to a public radio station's effort to establish a regional tribal media center. KSUT broadcasts in southwestern Colorado on two channels as Southern Ute Tribal Radio and Four Corners Public Radio. Executive Director Tammy Graham says the station's ongoing partnership with the tribe is unique.
The tribe founded KSUT, allowed it to become a 501c3 nonprofit, and we've become this very strong presence in the region, both with Tribal Radio and Four Corners Radio, and with the tribe coming back in 40 years later with this kind of support to help us move to the next level with a modern broadcast facility is very generous.
Graham says the fundraising campaign will allow KSUT to move into a new tribally owned building where they'll launch a regional news department and initiatives for preserving language and archiving oral histories. She says the new media center will also offer training opportunities for tribal members who want to establish their own broadcasting entities.
But to find a way, how can we on the ground, you know, support that effort by engaging and enabling tribal communities around the country to go out and cover what's happening in their communities to be better suited to tell their own stories.
The station has until October 2018 to raise $1 million to match the tribe's All or Nothing fund. Princeton graduates are helping out the Ramapo Lenape tribe in their protest of the disputed Mahwa Prayer Ground in New Jersey. NJ.com reports the graduates donated an alternative power supply unit that uses solar and wind to charge batteries. The prototype unit was designed by Princeton students as an alternative to diesel generators following the Haiti earthquake. The unit, housed in a shipping container, arrived Friday. Organizers say it will help out the tribe in their continued occupation of a 13-acre site. Local officials say the tribe is violating zoning laws. With National Native News, I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Support by BNSF Railway, proud partners of the American Indian Science and Education Society's National Conference, September 21st to 23rd, helping prepare the next generation of STEM leaders. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, this afternoon's volunteer host. And thank you to Jeff Brown, our producer, who is on the board. We have a quick public service announcement before we begin our interview today. The Mayor's Awards for the Arts and Juno Arts and Humanities Council annual meeting scheduled for this Friday at 5 p.m. has been rescheduled. That is rescheduled to Sunday, the 20th, at 4 o'clock at the Jack. Again, that's the Mayor's Awards for the Arts and the Juno Arts and Humanities Council annual meeting has been rescheduled from Friday at 5 to Sunday at 4 to accommodate the memorial service for Marianne Manning, which is Friday at 5:30 at the Jack. My first guest today is Phil Mundy. He is the director of the NOAA Lab. Glad to have you with us. And we are going to talk about the 10th anniversary of the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute, which is out on Lena Point and certainly has one of the more dramatic views in our community. What will be happening on Saturday for the 10th anniversary, Phil?
Well, thanks, Lori. We're going to have, starting at 12:30, an open house, and there will be several events within the open house for the public. At 1 o'clock, we're going to dedicate a marble bench that's been donated by the Ted Stevens Foundation in memory of our namesake, former Senator Ted Stevens, that has a view that you mentioned of South Shelter that is unimpeded. So it's a beautiful view, and it's we think it's a good way to remember the senator. Starting at 2 o'clock, there'll be tours of the lab for the public. And all during the 12:30 p.m. to 4 p.m. time frame, we're going to have touch tanks for the young and the young at heart to handle the marine creatures that we have in the nearshore environment.
So we're talking about the 10th anniversary of the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute. That will be this Saturday from 12:30 to 4 out at the NOAA Lab at Lena Point. Before we went on the show, we were reflecting on Senator Ted Stevens, as you said, the namesake of the institute there, and that it was his willingness to reach across the aisle that has helped to protect and save Alaska's fisheries. And we were reflecting on the Magnuson Act, which Senator Stevens worked on very closely with his Democratic counterpart from the state of Washington, Scoop Jackson. Talk a little bit about that act and why it has been so important for Alaska's fisheries.
Oh, be happy to. But first, I want to back up a little bit because people sometimes ask me, well, why in the world, you know, did they name that lab after that politician? They're always naming things after politicians. Well, I'll tell you, Senator Stevens earned that name on the laboratory because he was one of the most influential people in the history of the United States in terms of marine policy. And particularly, you mentioned the Magnuson-Stevens Act, although it's true, the people down in the boiler room, Scoop Jackson and Ted Stevens, weren't recognized until later. But it was Warren Magnuson, the very, very powerful senator from Washington State, who really helped push this through the Senate. But it was the thoughts of Senator Stevens that really put this on the table. Because he became concerned early on back in the 1960s that foreign fleets were coming in close to shore up to 3 miles from the coast of Alaska and taking fish. They took salmon and they took all other kinds of fish and really drove the populations down. We had some very, very low salmon runs in Bristol Bay in the early 1970s as a result, and we also lost a lot of our pollock and our rockfish in the Gulf of Alaska. So things were pretty tough back then. But Senator Stevens realized that putting in a 200-mile fishing limit, an equal, you know, a I should say a unilateral fishing limit, was the best way to go, and he convinced others in the Senate to back him.
Talk a little bit about what you think that act has done for Alaska fisheries. You have a lot of experience in this area. Do you think they would have been doomed without this act?
Oh, I think that clearly, as a whole, the fisheries in the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska would today, had it not been for the Magnuson-Stevens Act, have been producing very, very little rather than being one of the world's largest remaining commercial fisheries. I think that the main difference that the Magnuson-Stevens Act made was it, first of all, directed the income from those fisheries into the United States. So it changed the income from those fisheries was going to Russia and to Eastern Europe and to Taiwan and other places in the world and not into the United States. So the big impact on Alaska was it started putting money into people's pockets in Alaska. The other thing that it did is it gave fishery scientists like me a voice in the management of the fishery, and our job out at the Lena Point Lab is to provide numbers for the North Pacific Fishery Management Council that help them understand how they can sustainably harvest fish in the Bering Sea and the Gulf of Alaska.
Which our Constitution calls for in terms of how we manage resources, they must be managed sustainably.
Yes, absolutely. And we cooperate very closely with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game on all kinds of fisheries management, but of course the big item in the minds of Alaskans, I think, is salmon.
Certainly this last week it's been on the minds of Juneauites as the Derby went forward as a silver salmon derby due to the all-southeast closure on king salmon. What's going on there? Has the lab done some research into that particular species?
Yes, we've been working on Chinook salmon for some time, and what the federal government has to do with Chinook salmon in Alaska is some of our federal fisheries catch Chinook salmon inadvertently. We call this bycatch. They're not trying to catch them. They really don't want to catch them, but in the process of harvesting pollock in particular, they'll catch Chinook salmon. Some years ago, about 8 years ago, we had another downturn in Chinook salmon populations, and on a very, very broad scale, the Yukon, the Kuskokwim, and Nooshigak, those stocks were all going down. And when something like that happens, you're pretty sure that it's not a local problem in the Yukon or a local problem in the Kuskokwim. It's more than likely something that's going on in the ocean. And, of course, that's where we excel is in doing research on fish at sea. And we have worked very hard to understand exactly what's impacting the Chinook salmon in the ocean. We think that the downturn in Chinook salmon is due to changes in the food that they're eating, the quality and the abundance of food, due to warming in the Gulf of Alaska. You may have heard about the warm blob. We've had very, very warm surface conditions in the Gulf of Alaska, which bled over into the Bering Sea and even reached up into the northern Bering Sea and southern Chukchi. So these, whenever the climate changes like that, changes sharply, you can be sure that what the fish have to eat is going to change. And sometimes that's for the best, and sometimes it's not. And in this case, it appears to be not.
Is that something that's cyclic?
It used to be. But what seems to be happening now is that we do get ups and downs in temperatures, but the trend is up overall. So the highs are higher, and the lows are not as low. So we do get swings, oscillations in warm and cool conditions, but the trend is certainly up, you know, particularly in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea.
You mentioned that the specialty of the marine research aspect of the NOAA facility is fish at sea. And when the facility was built, there was some controversy about its location, in as much as the prior facility sat at the mouth of a freshwater creek, and that seemed to, according to some, be of a particular benefit. How has the location worked out? What are its advantages or perhaps also disadvantages?
Well, one of the big advantages, as you mentioned earlier, is that we have one of the best views in Juneau, and we invite people to come out to the lab for tours during the week at 1 p.m. But the facility itself was a major advantage in that it gave us 66,000 square feet of offices and laboratories, whereas the old facility at Auk Bay, which is we're called Auk Bay Labs, and Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute is our home base, our main building. Only had about 28,000 square feet of offices and laboratories in the whole lab at Auk Bay, and they were older. In fact, when I first came on the job there in 2005, I had a scientist tell me that he was concerned about office space, and I asked him about his office, and he said it was in a converted restroom. And so that was a source of his concern. So we were very, very cramped and crowded there. However, it's a beautiful location, lovely location, and we do have still have a research facility at Auk Creek, where many years of salmon research have been done. Nonetheless, being out at Atlantic Point gives us a lot more room, a lot more space. Of course, the major disadvantage with the Atlantic Point location is that the base of the building is 120 feet above sea level, and so that doesn't put you too close to the water, and of course we're on Favorite Channel, which is can pull pretty hard at times. So we don't have a dock out there. So we don't want to be a marine research institute without a dock. So we have docking facilities downtown here at the Subport Building, and until recently, we had docking facilities near Statter Harbor at the old Auk Bay Lab.
For folks who are interested in coming out either at the weekday tours at 1 o'clock or visiting during the 10th anniversary celebration this week, what might be a couple of things that would surprise visitors to that site?
Well, I think the number and variety of fish species that scientists have worked on at the lab. In fact, we have what we call the wall of fish, and we have a specimen of every species that scientists at the lab have worked on over the years, and it's huge, and it's growing. So be sure to see the wall of fish, and we have a caption down there that shows you what the different fish are. If there's no guide available at that time when you come, you can just come in between 8 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. and walk around in the atrium and take a look at our exhibits.
For your touch tank, what can be touched in the tank?
Well, certainly we have starfish, and one of my favorites is a sea cucumber, because you would think that a sea cucumber would be kind of a slimy thing and not something you'd want to touch, but they're actually quite nice to touch. And the only way that you can understand what I'm saying is by going and touching one. And sea anemones are interesting to touch, because sometimes you'll feel little pricks on your fingers when you put your finger down there, and their tentacles come because they are firing little spears into your skin. Of course, they're kind of microscopic spears, so they don't hurt too much, but that's the way they make their living.
How many scientists work out at the lab?
At present, we have about 63 federal scientists. This is down from 77 federal scientists, which we had out at the old lab when I first came here in 2005. But we have filled in with contractors so that we still have a complement of around 100 scientists, federal scientists and contractors.
Sounds like a lot of scientists. What would you say is the most important work that those professionals are looking at right now?
We have so many different professions out the lab. We have chemists and ecologists, biologists, mathematicians, statisticians. But we're all working on one thing, and that is to look at sustainable use of the marine environment. We are the National Marine Fisheries Service, and we look at how many fish are in the sea. That's essentially our task. And given enough funding, we can tell you exactly how many fish are in the sea. But normally, we don't have an infinite amount of money, and so we have to devise different approaches using nets and sonar and so forth to figure out how many fish are in the sea. But it's not, we found, especially during climate change, it's not enough to know how many you've got. You need to know why you have that many. That is, you need to know how the climate impacts the fish, how their predators and their prey impact the fish, because that way you can give the fishing industry and the public a little bit of a heads up on what's coming their way in terms of climate change.
We're talking with Phil Mundy. He is the director at the National Marine Fisheries Service Laboratory out at the Ted Stevens Marine Research Site that is at Lena Point. And they are having an open house this coming Saturday to honor the 10th anniversary of that institute. There will be a bench installed at that absolutely stunning view site, which folks can go have a picnic at anytime they want, right there at the lab. If you'd like to visit, show up around noon or 12:30. There will be a touch tank, various exhibits, and at 1 o'clock, the dedication ceremony. At 2 o'clock, there will be guided tours of the lab by scientists, as well as research films and various exhibits. Phil, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is taking a deep dive into the history of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, looking at how it's shaped our state. We're telling that story in an 8-episode podcast. Today, we're presenting Episode 5 on the radio. No download required. It was produced by Energy Desk reporters Elizabeth Jenkins and Jennifer Pemberton. Here's Elizabeth to start things off.
Even if you haven't been to Alaska, there are probably a few things you already know about the state. We have lots of bears, we eat lots of salmon, and the state itself is huge. But there might be something else you're familiar with.
Welcome to Alaska. Here's $1,000.
Well, it's about time. But why?
We pay every resident $1,000 to allow the oil companies to ravage our state's natural beauty.
I'm home.
The Simpsons got one thing right. In Alaska, we don't pay income tax. We don't have a state sales tax. But once a year, every single person in Alaska gets a check. Our permanent fund dividend, or PFD.
A quarter of the state's oil income goes into a type of savings account called a sovereign wealth fund. A lot of mineral-rich places have them, including Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. Texas funds public education with their oil money. And the Norwegians famously have nearly $1 trillion squirreled away in theirs.
And while there are plenty of other oil states in the world, Alaska is the only one that treats residents as shareholders of their oil wealth and cuts them a check each year.
Hello and welcome to Midnight Oil. I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
And I'm Elizabeth Jenkins. This is the story of how Alaska became an oil state that asks if we'll always be an oil state.
On today's episode, how Alaska decided to give a slice of its oil wealth every year to every man, woman, and child in the state. And what it means to have $60 billion in an untouchable savings account, especially when the state has a $2.5 billion hole in its budget.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. AYOGA is celebrating 40 years of Alaska's grit and determination that made Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline possible. Find more history at ourakspirit.com. With additional support from NPR Story Lab.
The idea of saving our oil money did not come naturally at first. After finding the biggest oil field in the United States in the late 1960s, the state auctioned off oil leases all along the North Slope, and it got a huge surprise.
They thought they would get a couple $1,000,000 from the auction, maybe 10. But those lease sales made $900 million, nine times the state's entire budget for that year. Alaska's lawmakers had a choice, save it or spend it. And what did they do?
Well, I don't have anything but a crude way to say. They went and pissed it up against the wall.
Clem Tillian was a state legislator at the time. He wanted to lock up the $900 million and throw away the key. But the state was only 10 years old at the time. Our economy was based on fish. We were barely scraping by. The legislature wanted to spend the money on infrastructure. And they did.
All sorts of fancy projects like grain storage and dreams and roads that pushed on into nowhere.
Not everyone agrees that we blew that money. That was the cash we used to make Alaska a real state with a real economy and real infrastructure. The bulk of it went to education.
But it makes sense that Tillian thinks the money was wasted. He's 92 years old and lives in Halibut Cove, Alaska, a community he founded in a house he built himself. You have to take a boat from the town of Homer to get there, the mail boat. It runs twice a week. He has a lighthouse, and his wife is buried in a mausoleum there.
I often introduce myself as the ghost of Christmas past, but I came wandering into this country after World War II with a case of malaria. My wife said that I was the first hippie to reach Homer and the homeliest looking boy she'd ever seen.
When he says he wandered into this country, he means he walked there from Anchorage, almost 250 miles.
And talking to him, it's obvious that Clem Tillian feels strongly about preserving things for future generations. He even has a reminder of his own mortality.
I keep a coffin just outside my door.
A coffin, really?
Yeah, I got a good price on it. There's a hatch. I should go stencil on it. Reserved, Clem Tillian.
This is not just the philosophy of a man staring death in the face. This is more or less the philosophy that drove him to fight for Alaska's permanent fund.
In 1976, the legislature passed a bill that would require the state to save 25% of all its oil money. And that fall, the people of Alaska voted it into the Constitution. But the legislature just couldn't agree on what to do with the money they were now saving. Remember, the state was still very young. A lot of lawmakers wanted to set up development programs with the money. They wanted to jumpstart their young government with it.
But that's exactly what Tillian wanted to avoid. He wanted to save it, all of it.
The royalties belong to the people. They should be invested for the long-term good of the people. And by that, I mean the child not yet born.
In 1980, Tillian was the Senate president and an admitted tyrant. He had support for a bill that would seed the permanent fund with $900 million. But a few powerful lawmakers were convinced that it shouldn't pass. And when it came time to vote, he says they refused to bring the bill down to the floor.
So I just called the colonel of the state troopers and said, I want them. And both of the troopers looked like gorillas, you know. They went up and just slapped handcuffs on them and brought them down.
At the end of the day, Tillian got his permanent fund, an untouchable savings account for future Alaskans. In 1977, oil started flowing down the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and money started flowing into the account. The fund was earning interest, but lawmakers couldn't figure out what to do with that interest. Governor Jay Hammond had an idea. Take that money, divvy it up, and give it to the people of Alaska. Here he is talking about it in a 1977 public TV program.
I want to make sure that everybody, at the conclusion of all this activity, can say, hey, I got a piece of the action.
Governor Jay Hammond has come up with what he thinks is a way to do just that. He wants to make the fund a corporation with every Alaskan a shareholder.
He called his plan Alaska Inc.
This was Hammond's idea, the dividend.
Where Clem Tillian was the champion of the permanent fund, Governor Jay Hammond was the champion of the permanent fund dividend. Hammond wanted the oil money equally distributed across the state, to rural and urban areas, rich and poor. He was worried that if the government was responsible for deciding where to spend that money, it would go to pet projects, to well-connected politicians, or that it would stay in Juneau and Anchorage. We are the only oil state in the world that hands out dividend checks like this. But this crazy social experiment, it just kind of happened. Governor proposes idea. Idea becomes bill. Bill becomes law. Checks go in the mail.
It took a few years for the PFD to wind its way through the legislature. There was some debate, some political pushback. A lawsuit that went to the Supreme Court. But the story ends like this. In 1982, dividend checks for $1,000 were dropped in the mail to every Alaska resident. And when people first got their permanent fund dividend checks, what was that like?
I don't think they really believed it until the check came. When you collect that check, it is your share as an owner of the resource. With the permanent fund, we converted a non-renewable resource to a renewable, and you get a piece of that every year.
Elizabeth, you haven't gotten a PFD yet, right?
No. You have to live in the state for one calendar year, so this one will be my first, and then I'll get one for every year after that.
And what are you going to spend it on?
Since I can do with it what I want, I'll probably spend my share of the oil wealth in Mexico.
So the place where all that money is managed, I can see it from my house.
Really?
And everyone's PFD is in there, two blocks from my house. I picture this giant vault in there with all of Alaska's oil riches in it.
I'm Angela.
Jennifer.
Nice to meet you, Jennifer.
I'm Elizabeth. Nice to meet you.
Do you want to come into my office?
We're here at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation headquarters in Juneau. It's a big, blocky building downtown, and Angela Rodell, who has just introduced herself to us by her first name, is the CEO. She runs this place. This place that manages the state's $60 billion savings account. It's noon, and everyone is either at lunch or gone home. Many of the investment analysts get in at 5 in the morning, so they'll be ready when the markets open on the East Coast. And I have all these ideas, like the Wolf of Wall Street, like people yelling in phones and making, like, fast decisions. Is it ever like that in here? Is it ever that hectic?
Usually it stays pretty calm. Although there could be some yelling going on, I guess, occasionally. You never know.
But today, there's no yelling. In fact, it's extremely quiet, which is hard to imagine for a firm that has more than $200 million in Apple stocks and owns entire city blocks in Manhattan. As Alaskans, we own shopping centers in Spain and Portugal, a Crate and Barrel store, and a swanky D.C. neighborhood. We have stocks in companies in more than 70 different countries, including Harley-Davidson and Tesla, Budweiser and Avon. And the fund is doing really well.
We're having a very good year. So we've completed 11 months of the fiscal year, and we are up $7 billion over where we started the fiscal year.
It's easy to forget the fund's humble origins when you're here talking about your global portfolio. But the first deposit was just $700,000, and it used to be all oil money.
Our royalty income is now a very small portion of what we get on an annual basis.
The fund earns twice as much in interest each month as it gets from oil money each year. True to Jay Hammond's vision, every resident in Alaska is a shareholder of this wealth. But not all Alaskans feel that included in the whole thing. Remember, most people in the state live outside the capital city. So for them, the Permanent Fund Corporation is out of sight, out of mind. To really understand what the Permanent Fund means to Alaskans, we knew we had to get out of Juneau. Alaska is made up of a lot of small communities that are not connected to the main road system. The village of Angoon is a short seaplane ride from Juneau, but it's definitely a whole other world. About 400 people live here. The unemployment rate is high, and so is the cost of living. A box of Raisin Bran at the only store in town costs $7. Residential electricity comes from a giant diesel generator, and most people pay hundreds of dollars a month to heat their homes in the winter. We wanted to visit Angoon to see if the PFD even makes a dent in the cost of living. Evangeline Howard tells us her house is the one with a bunch of cars out front. There's no easy way to get broken down cars off the island, so nearly all of the houses have a bunch of cars out front. But we find her eventually and join her on a very special errand.
Today we got blessed. One of my friends called me and said, "My son's giving you a king salmon."
Evangeline Howard has lived here almost all her life. We're driving along the village's 7 miles of paved road, past a bay dotted with fishing vessels, until we reach a house tucked in the trees.
I gotta go and get the fish.
The king salmon is on the porch, glistening in a large white cooler. It takes up the whole thing.
Look at that.
Wow, what a blessing. Gee.
She said, give him everything. Give him the whole thing.
Her husband, Mike, heaves the salmon over his shoulder. We're talking about more than 20 pounds of meat, several meals for the couple. And to understand why this fish is such a blessing to them, you have to understand life in Angoon.
You know, we don't have a restaurant here. We don't have a bank here. We've got the one store and the one gas station.
Albert Kukesh III works for the city of Angoon. He grew up here, but he likes to get out of town at least once a month. Usually that means boarding the ferry, arriving in Juneau hours later, and buying several weeks' worth of groceries. But once a year, his family gets to imagine something different. And he says it's all because of their PFD. In fact, Albert calls it a birthday gift, and he tries to use it on treats for his family, like trips to Disneyland. When Albert went to college in Colorado, he realized that getting a check from his home state was pretty unique.
You know, you definitely feel Alaskan. And, you know, people are like, do you really get paid for living there? And you're like, yeah, yeah.
But in the village, Albert recognizes he's one of the lucky ones. Last year, 1 in 10 Alaskans had at least part of their dividend collected to pay debt.
And almost everyone we spoke with in Angoon had experienced that at some point. For Albert, the PFD is a bonus because he has a job. He says most people who live in Angoon don't. Mike and Evangeline Howard remember a time when the state was just starting to build its oil wealth, and Angoon was growing too.
But as the price of oil continues to drop, the couple says they've had to pay more to live in Angoon. The PFD pays some of the bills, but not all of them. The Howards are on a fixed income, and in the past few years, state programs like heating assistance have gone away.
And now we're going to get even less this year. Energy assistance really helped us out.
And over the years, Evangeline and Mike have watched people from their village move away. Angoon's infrastructure, which was once shiny and new when Alaska was flush with oil money, is starting to crumble.
The oil money is still there, in the maturing permanent fund, but the state can't touch it. And that idea, money just floating in the ether, that puzzles Mike.
Where's it going? We don't see it here in Angoon.
Everything about what we've decided to do with our oil money in Alaska, from the permanent fund to the dividend, it's been a giant experiment, and we're still in the middle of it.
The state is at a serious crossroads, and no one knows what's going to happen.
The permanent fund is supposed to be just that, permanent. But here's the thing. Oil prices and production are down, and it's becoming very clear that we just can't rely on oil money anymore to fund our government.
Alaska has a budget deficit of more than $2 billion, which makes that $60 billion savings account awfully tempting.
Constitutionally, we can't touch the principal of the fund, but the legislature can change what we do with the interest. And they have. For 2 years in a row now, the dividend has been capped, meaning Alaskans are getting half of their PFD checks. The state is taking the rest and saving it, with the hopes of figuring out a way to use it to pay for government eventually.
This is Clem Tillian's nightmare.
To take something from the permanent funds that belongs to the people.
Tillian was in Juneau this summer lobbying to block this year's PFD cut and to sue the governor for cutting it last year.
If oil money isn't paying the bills, then we have to find another source of income, like taxes. This is a song that Tillian has been singing for a long time. When Alaska got rid of its income tax in 1980, he was the only one who voted against its repeal.
If we don't figure out how to solve our budget woes, we'll have no choice but to start spending our savings, as Angela Rodell of the Permanent Fund Corporation is well aware.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, if you were in a tight spot where there was nothing left, I don't know how you would not spend that money if that was the only thing you had left to tap.
Back when Alaska's oil was discovered, Tillian had the forethought to see the end was near. Oil dries up. Old men die. There's only one thing he regrets.
Well, I regret that we didn't put away more, but I'm proud of the fact that we did give to the people.
Does it give you comfort that even after you're gone, you've left behind this thing, the permanent fund, that will still live on?
If my children have a decent chance for life due to anything I've done, then I'm a success. To take care of my children, I'm forced to take care of yours. Look what happened to the French aristocracy in the 1700s. No, thank you. You know, you always have to take care of the little guy.
So I'm guessing we can resolve Alaska's budget problem without guillotines.
But we might have to tap into the permanent fund.
This isn't the first time Alaska has been in a recession. Next time on Midnight Oil, the big bust of the 1980s. It was Alaska's Great Recession, 20 years before the rest of the country went through almost the same thing.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Midnight Oil. Our story was edited by Annie Feit and mixed by Dave Waldron.
James Glaves composed our theme music.
Besides the voices you heard in the program, we also had help from Cliff Groh, Andrew Kitchenman, Rasha McChesney, and Rachel Waldholz.
Our media producer extraordinaire is Eric Keto. He interviewed a few of the folks who live and work along the pipeline today. This week, he'll introduce you to Adam Owen, who drives, flies, or snowcats along a 100-mile stretch of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, making sure oil stays in the line. You can check out the video and more at alaskapublic.org. I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm this afternoon's volunteer host, Lori Scandling. It is about 18 minutes before the hour. With me is my guest, Lionel Yudapa. He is the executive chef at SALT, and he is the recent winner as of August 5th of the American Seafood Festival Contest in New Orleans. Glad to have you here, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I understand there were, 14 competitors from around the country?
There was 13, including
13.
Myself.
And mm-hmm. How were you chosen? What was that process?
So I was appointed by the governor and from ASME, which is Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. But I think you can either go that route or you have to, for other states, enter in a competition and compete against, I want to say, 4 to 5 other chefs in order to compete in the Great American Seafood Competition.
And go up to the next level then.
Correct.
What was the dish and how did you conceive it? I saw a picture of it and the presentation was unique, mm-hmm. as were some of the flourishes and the food in it. Describe how you conceived of the dish and what it was.
So we did an Alaskan king crab risotto, and I grew up in a Filipino household, and rice was a very important meal of, whenever we ate. So we wanted to do something a little bit more familiar, and that required a lot more finesse when cooking. So we did risotto, and it consisted of me just making a really nice vegetable stock. To cook the rice in and stirring the rice with a wooden spoon for about 55 minutes.
That risotto needs to be plump and soft.
Yes.
So, and then the crab itself was prepared in a particular way. Describe that process.
So, yes, the crab was cooked over natural coals and alder. When we cook at the restaurant, we use, the same ingredients, natural oak and some alder wood to give it that nice smoky flavor. And we basted it with cultured butter, to give it a little bit more of a bite and a chew to it, which worked out really well. It's delicious.
And then I saw what looked like a small flower vase next to it with some items inside of it. What was that about?
So we wanted to really put the crab on the podium and try to present it in the most beautiful ways possible. So it was laying on a bed of sea rocks and sea asparagus that we foraged Wednesday before our trip to New Orleans. But we also skewered it with some blueberry branches that we foraged as well, with the blueberries still attached.
And I noticed on the risotto there was also some salmon roe. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that salmon roe was something that was used very frequently.
Yeah, it's amazing. It gave the dish some complexity and some umami along with some saltiness. But, I mean, salmon roe is usually – that's underestimated. Not a lot
it's
of people use it.
Discarded typically, is it
yeah.
not? Yeah.
So we wanted to highlight that as well. Plus, it gave it some beautiful contrast.
So I understand there is not a particular prize associated with this. You get to wear a crown, but not like a cash prize or anything. What is the benefit of winning the Great American Seafood Festival contest?
For us, it's promoting Alaskan seafood and, you know, just bragging rights. It was really fun for us and challenging to be accepted and to go to New Orleans. But also we've been getting a lot of PR and just a lot of random phone calls and, you know, being the front page of the papers, really an honor.
You used the word we. Was it a team that went, and who else joined you?
It was my sous chef, Jacob Pickard, who joined me.
And did he help with coming up with the idea and the design, or was that essentially your creativity?
Well, we have the king crab risotto on our menu, and we were just kind of stumped on what we wanted to cook for this competition, and he just insisted that we, you know, bring the risotto with us, and I thought it was a great idea, so we kind of just tried to perfect it, you know, as much as possible, and made it ready to just showcase.
When you were at the event itself, did you look around and see other dishes that were stunners and think, uh-oh, I don't know how we're going to do?
Yes, Massachusetts came in second, and he did a deconstructed clam bake with lobster that was just
what
amazing.
Does that mean, a deconstructed clam bake? How do you deconstruct a clam bake?
Well, I guess it's usually served as a stew, I want to say, or a soup. But it wasn't that at all. He made a really nice corn sauce that's also used in a clam bake. He added lobster that was really beautiful and some razor clams. And I think he made his own oyster crackers as well, which is really fascinating.
They would have to be very delicate.
Yes.
Delicately made. Those oyster crackers are so tender. Mm-hmm. So did you and Jake eat the dish afterwards, or did you all get to have a taste of the various competitions that were submitted?
We ate our dish, and we practiced in our hotel room, just kind of timed ourselves and made sure we had the proper amount of sea asparagus, the proper amount of salmon roe, the acidity, and the saltiness, and the overall presentation of the dish, how long we could smoke the crab for. But we ate just a whole bowl of that and just kind of revised it very last minute and counted how many eggs we put on the plate.
You actually counted the salmon eggs?
I mean, towards maybe the last two or three dishes we didn't, because we were kind of just scrunched with time.
So was there a specific amount of time that you had as part of this process? For example, 1 hour, and was the clock ticking while that happened?
Yeah, we had an hour to prepare it.
In front of everybody,
In front of everyone.
Yeah.
We were number 12 on the spot to present our dish. So it was kind of a benefit for us just kind of see what everyone else was doing and how they explained their dish and presented it. But I think we did a really good job.
I think they thought so, too.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your history becoming what is pretty honored chef in this community and now nationwide. What was your journey?
I started off by going to culinary school in Atlanta, Georgia, back in 2006. And, you know, after culinary school was finished, I wanted to be back on the West Coast and kind of just focus more on the farm-to-table salad cuisine, and a lot of great seafood comes from the West Coast, so I wanted, you know, to be by the water. So after I left Georgia, I moved to San Diego to go work at the Lodge at Torrey Pines and did an internship there with Chef Jeff Jackson. And then we held a Buick invitation, and I was there for about a year and a half, and then decided to move to Laguna Beach to go work for the Montage Resort, and worked for a restaurant called Studio under Craig Strong, and it was strictly just all seafood that we did. During the winter, we'd change our menu and have some wild game, but it was a restaurant that was just on the bluff, and
must have been beautiful.
Yeah, we got some really amazing seafood from all over the world. We'd get Copper River salmon. We'd get scallops from New York. And so it was a great experience.
Talk about your time in Chicago. I found that impressive.
So, yeah, I was just looking for more experience, and I was just really, really hungry to...
No pun intended. Yeah,
to just learn more and kind of develop myself as a chef. And so I moved to Chicago to go work for free for about a year. And I worked for a restaurant called True, T-R-U. And I worked under Anthony Martin, who was the protege for Joël Robuchon, who just got awarded the Chef of the Century.
Got some nice connections there.
Pretty amazing. So I did 6 months with him and then moved around to a restaurant called Next that was owned by Chef Grant Aikitz, owned Alinea, which is also a really nice restaurant.
We're talking with Lionel Utipa. He is a chef, the executive chef with Salt, and he and his sous chef, Jake Picard, just won the Great American Seafood Cook-Off Contest a week ago Saturday in New Orleans. Congratulations. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 14th of August, 2017. It's the anniversary of the day on which the Social Security Act was signed into law, 1935, by President Franklin D. Roosevelt, intended to help keep senior citizens out of poverty. It's the birthday of the cartoonist Gary Larson, born Tacoma, Washington, 1950, creator of the comic strip The Far Side, ran for 15 years, an anthropomorphic comic strip about cows who spoke and vipers who wore cat's eye glasses and dogs who played a game called Tether Cat. It's the birthday of Ernest Thayer, born Lawrence, Massachusetts, 1863, went off to Harvard, studied philosophy with William James, went out to San Francisco where he worked for the Hearst paper, the San Francisco Examiner, wrote a humor column for them, and sometimes light verse, and in 1888 he wrote a poem, Casey at the Bat, which was picked up by other papers, including the New York Sun, which left his name off it, and the comedian and actor William DeWolf Hopper saw the poem printed. He performed the poem, and it was so popular, he made a career out of it. Hopper performed the poem almost 40,000 times, though he didn't know who had written it until Ernest Thayer happened to come to one of his shows. Ernest Thayer never got any royalties from Casey at the Bat, nor did he ask for any. He got old, and he went back to the study of philosophy, and he published some articles on the subject, and he was somewhat dismayed to find out that he was always going to be known for this little poem that he'd written when he was just 24 years old. It's the birthday of Daniel Steele, New York City, 1947, who produces a book every year, has sold almost 600 million of them. It's the birthday of the humorist Russell Baker, born 1925, Morrisonville, Virginia, columnist for the New York Times for many years, and then went on television to host Masterpiece Theater in 1992. Russell Baker said, "Television is harder than I thought. I can't bear to look at myself. I fancied that I was an exceedingly charming, witty, and handsome young man, and here's this fidgeting old fellow whose hair is parted on the wrong side." And it's the birthday of Doc Holliday, John Henry Doc Holliday, born Griffin, Georgia, 1851, studied dentistry, got tuberculosis, moved west, became a gambler, wound up in Tombstone, Arizona in 1880, where he took up with the Earp brothers, who were carrying on a feud with a gang of the Clantons. And there was a famous shootout at the O.K. Corral, October 1881, 30 shots fired in about 30 seconds. Three men were killed, many were wounded. Holliday survived. He died of tuberculosis 6 years later. Here's a poem by Charles Simich, The Saint. The woman I love is a saint who deserves to have people falling on their knees before her in the street asking for her blessing. Instead, here she is on the floor, hitting a mouse with a shoe as tears run down her face. The Saint by Charles Simich from Scribbled in the Dark, published by Echo and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Is Bird Note. It's a lovely day along the California coast near Big Sur. A steady, cooling breeze from the ocean pushes a strong updraft along the seaside cliffs. Soaring above is one of our continent's most spectacular birds and one of its most endangered, the California condor. California condors are the largest soaring birds in North America with a wingspan of over 9 feet. During the days of mammoths and saber-toothed cats, they thrived over much of the continent. 200 years ago, condors were found from California to southern British Columbia. But by 1987, there were only 27 condors left, and these were held in captivity to foster the species' return to the wild. Today, there are nearly 300 free-flying condors living in the wild, and around 200 or so in captivity. Yet, the wild population is not self-sustaining. Unlike many species, the condor's main survival problem is not habitat loss. It's high mortality due to lead poisoning. Condors eat animal carcasses, often containing lead from hunters' bullets. But a state law passed in California in 2013 aims to eliminate the use of lead completely by 2019. That's a change that could enable condors to once again thrive and soar in the Golden State. Learn more at birdnote.org. I'm Mary McCann.
And thanks for joining us today on a Juno afternoon. Looking ahead at the weather throughout the week, rain is likely every day, at least through Sunday, with highs near the mid-50s.
6AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210 AM in Gustavus, K220 BT in Hoonah, and K210 AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KT.